From Iowa to Maryland, Tennessee to Washington, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, President Joe Biden's job approval rating has taken a nosedive among key voter groups that powered his 2020 election victory. Timothy Head from the Faith and Freedom Coalition is here to explain why. The inflation rate hit a 40-year high in January, clocking in at 7.5%. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story on the impact. Some states are finding themselves with hefty budget surpluses. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine talks with Josh Goodman at the Pew Charitable Trust about how they can avoid making mistakes in spending that money. And a couple of weeks ago, President Biden rhetorically asked, "What are Republicans for?" Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA has the answer on this week's American Radio Journal Commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. President Joe Biden's job approval numbers have tanked among registered independents, suburbanites, Hispanics, and other groups that contributed to his win in 2020. Here to talk about why this is happening is Timothy Head. He is executive director of the Faith and Freedom Coalition. Tim, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Tim, President Biden, just a little bit over a year into his term here, he came in with some solid support, particularly among progressives, support among independents, Hispanics, extremely strong support in suburban areas. We've seen a lot of that change. Before we get into specific subgroups, what do you see as driving this change where the president's job approval rating, especially among those groups, continues to fall?
Well, it's a good question, and I think this is a very ripe conversation to be having, as you mentioned, one year now into his presidency. Each of those different demographics that we're going to break down in a moment have slightly different reasons for it. But I would say the largest kind of category of this is anytime you have a shift in an administration, like we saw from the Trump administration to the Biden administration, a lot of kind of not necessarily base political party voters, but just kind of quote-unquote normal Americans, independents and persuadable people are just looking, there's a sense of hope. Well, unfortunately, fairly early on in the Biden administration, a lot of people kind of recognized that that there wasn't much delivery on the promises that had been made during the campaign for the Biden administration. And so we started seeing in the summertime a pretty significant and consistent drop. But the real kind of precipitous moment happened in the really tragic scenario surrounding the Afghanistan pullout last year. And from that point on, really, the kind of confidence level and belief of a bunch of kind of not only the partisan voters, but just these kind of middle of the road persuadable folks has really dropped off the table. And Biden really is not done a significant thing, anything significant to recover that confidence.
One of the areas geographically, Tim, where President Trump had a weakness was in the suburban areas around the country, and particularly among college-educated suburban women. What are we seeing happen in those regions and with that particular demographic group?
First of all, they really want sort of stability, overall societal stability, including economic stability, and they also have a very strong felt need for safety, especially obviously for their children. So many of these ladies in those situations. And so I think that what we're seeing as the pandemic has kind of drawn out and the economic implications of that, that a lot of people are, particularly these suburban women, are not feeling or seeing that stability. Obviously, kids are in different pockets of the country, are still at home, or maybe they're going to school and they're having to mask, or, you know, there's kind of ebbs and flows to all of this. And so, once again, the Biden administration kind of sold hope and if you will, change, pun somewhat intended, but they haven't delivered really on either of those. It's basically kind of like Groundhog's Day again and again, that we're still shut down, schools are still unusual, and the economy is still kind of sluggish in a lot of parts of the country. No significant policy changes. I mean, just now, like literally in the last 2 weeks, we're starting to see states lift at the urging of the White House and various federal agencies. And so I think that it's still going to be a long time before the Biden administration is able to truly persuasively make their case to these white suburban college-educated women.
In terms of stability, as you've pointed out, not only white college-educated suburban women, but pretty much everybody, Tim, wants some sort of stability or predictability. And between COVID and inflation and rising crime, we haven't had that. Is this something that's playing out across all demographic groups, and particularly the so-called persuadables?
Yes, it absolutely is, which is why a White House and a kind of a presidential messaging apparatus can focus certain messages for each of these different demographics and kind of silos of American society. But the reason why you're seeing just really incredibly low favorable rates for Biden personally and for the Biden administration is because every single silo is nearing its low point in favorability. And so Trump, as administration, kind of bottomed out at like 38% favorable. Amazingly, the Biden administration is, I think they've probably hit the bottom now, but they were kind of hovering around 34-35%, which is the lowest that we've seen in literally decades. And it's because really nobody thinks that things are going well. And nobody also thinks that Biden is helping anything that's going poorly. So it really has become sort of a cross-section of all groups of America.
Let's talk a bit more about Hispanics. Of course, the Biden administration has pursued pretty much an open border policy along the southern border. But Hispanics who are here, particularly those, Tim, who came here legally, have gone through the process of becoming citizens or are going through it. We're now starting to see them swing more and more into the Republican column. Is this a backlash against Biden, or is it a favorable reaction to the Republican agenda?
First of all, Hispanics, especially on border states, interestingly enough, the political left has really kind of misdiagnosed what those Hispanics want. A lot of those have been here for two and three generations. A lot of those families have. And so this notion of open borders and kind of lax immigration policy is actually just the opposite, because so many of those people had to work so hard to get to America that they actually don't like the notion of people from wherever, Mexico, Honduras, Colombia, et cetera, kind of moving to the front of the line. And then secondly, back to the economy and inflation, et cetera, is the reason why most of those people came either was for economic opportunity or for kind of political stability and safety. And whenever you compromise both of those things, those people who came here for those purposes, or maybe who their families before them came for those purposes, are not just kind of like irritated, but their political philosophy actually is flipped. Unfortunately, for a lot of Hispanics, this is not actually the America that they even desired to come to.
We have been talking with Timothy Head. Tim is Executive Director of the Faith and Freedom Coalition. Tim, tell us a bit about the Faith and Freedom Coalition. Also, where can folks go on the web to learn more about your organization?
Well, the Faith and Freedom Coalition really exists for one kind of fundamental reason. And the way we like to say it is we exist to give Christians a voice in government. And people can learn more about us at ffcoalition.com.
Timothy Head of the Faith and Freedom Coalition. Tim, thank you for being here.
Thank you. God bless.
At the Club for Growth, we have Scott Parkinson, who's been keeping an eye on major economic news this week. Scott, good to have you here.
Thanks for having me back, Loman.
It is major news. It's not good news. Latest inflation numbers out. Please bring us up to date.
Well, this week, the U.S. Labor Department made a major announcement that inflation has increased over the past 12 months by 7.5%. And that's the highest level since 1982. We've been talking about the end of the Carter years for a little while on the program in other episodes. And you know, we've talked about inflation really being this hidden tax increase on the American people. And I think at this point, it's not so hidden. Folks are really starting to feel the pain of Joe Biden's economic policies and what that means for consumer prices and everything that we're looking at, whether it's retail, energy prices, certainly groceries. And the bottom line is, I think it's really starting to be a pinch on the health of the middle class. It's already been incredibly fractured over the past couple of years due to the coronavirus pandemic. So when we go back to the history books in a decade and wonder how did this all happen, folks are certainly going to look at all the federal spending and the amount of debt that we took on, what that did to supply chains, what Biden's regulatory and environmental policies have done for the energy sector. And these are day-to-day necessary costs that are being incurred by the American people. And when you have a weakened middle class, the overall strength of the U.S. economy is beyond fractured, in my view. And so this is not something that's going to be going away in the short term. This is something I think that folks are going to be feeling throughout the remainder of Joe Biden's presidency. And that's why we need to get a new president in place in 2024 that actually believes in these ideas of free market economic conservatism, where we can increase investment opportunities, where we can reduce the level of taxation and regulation that businesses and job creators and entrepreneurs want to take on and when it comes to those risk management decisions.
In the preceding interview here, Tim Head from the Faith and Freedom Coalition, Scott, talked about how we're seeing a movement among independent voters, Hispanics, suburbanites. All of this bad economic news, is this starting to really add fuel to Republican hopes for regaining control of Congress in November?
Well, I think so, for sure. And right now, obviously, we all feel really good about winning back the House of Representatives. It's already almost a de minimis majority for Nancy Pelosi when it comes to the number of seats that she has in the House. And so what a functioning majority really means is usually you've got 15, 20, 30 seats as a surplus where you can actually lose votes and still enact an agenda. But we've seen the Biden agenda completely stalled. The Build Back Better Act is totally dead. It was killed in the Senate. I think that there are a lot of House members that are going to really regret walking the plank and taking those votes when it comes to November of 2022. And throughout the country, we're also seeing a reassessment of the so-called science when it comes to mask mandates. And I think instead, a lot of these politicians are recognizing that there's political science behind the decisions on forcing people to basically adjust their behavior when it comes to the coronavirus pandemic, whether it's wearing a mask, being vaccinated, the way that they treat children in schools. We all saw the viral picture of Stacey Abrams in a classroom full of masked students and other school administrators, and she, of course, was not wearing a mask. I'm fine with her not wearing a mask around kids, but I don't think the kids need to wear a mask either. And the bottom line is the federal government, in many ways, is turning into an oligarchy where the elitists have different rules that don't apply to the masses. And that becomes a real problem when the masses are the ones that elect a free and open government. And so that's why I think you're seeing all this backlash from Democrat governors. They met with Biden this week, and we've seen them all, well, many of them, take down their own requirements and mandates on masking, from governors in New York, Rhode Island, New Jersey, Connecticut, Delaware, Oregon, and California. I think that it's sort of a move-on mentality that the Democrats want to try to whitewash the history here on who was supporting lockdowns and mandates. And, of course, they're probably going to try to blame Republicans because Republicans didn't follow the rules for a short amount of time. But I'm certainly going to remember for a long time what they said, a few weeks to stop the spread, and then, you know, a few months, and then, oh, we got to all get vaccinated. And as long as a number of people are vaccinated, well, there's a new variant and it doesn't work with this certain vaccine. There was a boneheaded comment this week from Representative Sean Patrick Maloney. And he said that he thought it was time to, quote, give people their lives back. And that, once again, goes back to this idea of an oligarchy where these powerful politicians actually think that they have control over people's lives.
Now, we have another major issue to discuss here, Scott. It is Super Bowl weekend. We have the Los Angeles Rams surprisingly taking on the Cincinnati Bengals. What is your prediction?
Well, I'm predicting sort of a slugfest, high-scoring game. I think that the NFL certainly wants to see, bring that excitement. And you got to remember that this game typically lasts close to 4 hours, given the extended halftime show. And to me, when you've got more scoring, that means more commercial opportunities. It just feels like the refs are going to let them play. So I'm taking the over for sure. And I'm going to take the Bengals 42 against the Rams 37.
Ooh. Well, I'm a Steeler fan, so I can't ever take the Bengals for anything. So given that, I'm going to predict a Rams victory on Sunday. We'll see next week who wins this battle. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth. A few words about the club, Scott.
Yeah, the Club for Growth is a membership organization. Our members are united in this idea of liberty, opportunity, and freedom. And if you want to check us out, our website is clubforgrowth.org, and you can actually sign up with 500,000 other members for free.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, we'll talk with you next week. Thank you.
Thank you.
Flush with federal stimulus cash and a rapidly rebounding economy, many states have big budget surpluses. To find out how they can avoid making mistakes in spending that money, Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine talks with Josh Goodman from the Pew Charitable Trusts.
It's arguably never been a better time to be a state lawmaker than right now, because as a lot of states are heading into their budget sessions and the legislative sessions of the spring and early summer, well, there is a ton of cash to be spent. But the big question is how best to spend it. And the answer, not surprisingly, is don't spend it all right now. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Josh Goodman. He's a senior officer at the State Fiscal Health Initiative within the Pew Charitable Trusts. And he joins us now to talk about this important topic, about the unique situation that a lot of states find themselves in this year. Josh, thanks for taking some time with us today.
Absolutely. My pleasure. Anytime.
So states are coming out of the pandemic here, or I guess, you know, fingers crossed, we're coming out of the pandemic here in much stronger shape fiscally and budgetarily than maybe we thought they were.
Absolutely. And what you're seeing this year is state after state saying we have a budget surplus. And that's just a huge change compared to the spring of 2020 when tax revenue fell precipitously at the very beginning of the pandemic when the economy shut down. And states were really worried at that time about their ability to bounce back, but it's been a complete 180 where states now are saying we have these large budget surpluses and are trying to decide what to do with them.
Is it across the board surpluses? Are we seeing certain states that are outliers, or is it just about everybody's got, you know, I don't know what, 10-12% more revenue than last year?
Well, even states that we think of as some of the most fiscally challenged states in the country are reporting surpluses. So it might not be totally universal, but for example, Illinois, they're talking about a budget surplus this year. Now, if you look out longer term in Illinois, they still report a structural budget deficit. And so there are longer term challenges. But for states, many of the factors that are causing these surpluses are universal from state to state. There's generous federal aid, both under the American Rescue Plan Act, but also under earlier federal relief legislation. That's bolstering states. States are bolstered by also the relief that federal government has given to individuals, and to the extent that's propping up and has propped up the economy, that's also helped state tax collections. And then there are other temporary factors that are helping states. Spending on, for example, goods rather than services. States don't always tax services, but they usually tax goods. And so that's really helped sales tax revenue.
Yeah, states, of course, primarily rely on sales taxes. And of course, the federal government giving lots of money out during the pandemic, lots of to help keep the economy afloat. But people turn around and spend that money on things, and then that goes into state coffers. And then the states also got more aid from the federal government. I guess we could also add to that pile, this is not there yet, but I mean, there's a lot of money in the infrastructure bill coming down the pike that will also help state budgets as well. If you're a state lawmaker right now, it's got to be a pretty good time, right? I mean, this is not a situation that they normally find themselves in budget season, but that exuberance maybe needs to be tempered a little bit.
Definitely. So, and the nice thing that we're seeing, what's really encouraging, is this recognition that there is the risk of a cliff coming up. And so under the Rescue Plan Act, the flexible relief has to be allocated by 2024 and spent by 2026. So once that money's gone, states really need to be asking, what is our long-term budget position? Will long-term revenue collection support long-term spending demands? And if the answer to that is yes, then states have a lot of flexibility right now in terms of making new investments, whether those are tax cuts, whether those are new programs, whatever might be lawmakers' priorities. But if what they see over the long term is a structural imbalance, not enough revenue to pay for spending, that speaks to being more cautious right now and thinking about maybe there's some one-time things we can do that won't entail an ongoing commitment that could cause us budget problems down the road.
We're talking with Josh Goodman. He's a senior officer with the State Fiscal Health Initiative at the Pew Charitable Trusts, talking about the state budget situation, which is pretty rosy this year in a lot of state capitals. And Josh, you were just saying that there's really kind of this choice that lawmakers and governors and everybody involved in this process are facing at the moment. If you have a lot of extra money to spend as a state government, you can, you know, use that to build out new programs, to expand government, to offer new services, whatever it may be, fill in the blank there. But before lawmakers do that, you have to have a plan not just to set up the program but to pay for it long term. And that's really the big question mark here, because this is in many cases a one-time revenue surge.
Exactly. And as you were saying earlier, state lawmakers aren't used to being in this situation. If you are a state lawmaker that's been in office for the last 15 years, you know, you governed through first the Great Recession, then a very slow recovery from the Great Recession. Then finally, states felt like they were getting in a good position, and then suddenly the pandemic hit. So it's understandable that there's all this pent-up demand for different kinds of either programs or on the tax side, tax cuts. And the question is not just what's the budget situation this year, but 5 years or 10 years down the road.
Yeah, like whatever your pet project is, oh, this is the time because we finally have the money for it, that sort of attitude.
Exactly. And also states are facing pressure from some of the same factors in the economy that private businesses are. And so we have published an analysis showing that wage growth in state and local government is lagging behind the private sector. And so the private sector is more responsive sometimes to this kind of thing where they'll raise wages, and then states are saying, you know, why can't we hire any prison guards, or why are our school districts saying we can't find bus drivers? And so that's creating pressure for these ongoing commitments in terms of wage increases, and that's understandable, but states still need to be thinking about long-term, what will we be able to afford?
Yeah, definitely not as easy as just, hey, there's a lot more money here, let's spend it. State lawmakers have to be more careful than that. That is unfortunately all the time we have for today. Josh, thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. I enjoyed it.
And once again, that is Josh Goodman. He is a senior officer at the Pew Charitable Trusts with their State Fiscal Health Initiative. You can check out his work online at pewtrusts.org. Check out our coverage of issues in the states and all over the country at reason.com. And for Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Claiming Republicans only oppose his agenda, President Biden recently asked, "What are Republicans for?" Several have stepped forward with the answer, as we learn from Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA on this American Radio Journal commentary.
President Joe Biden just gave an enormous gift to the Republican Party in general and to the Republicans potentially running for president in 2024 in particular. By cynically and sarcastically asking, "What are Republicans for?" he gave them a map that, properly followed, will lead them to victory. Many of our American Radio Journal listeners will remember the contract with America that Newt Gingrich helped craft in 1994 that is credited with bringing in the largest Republican congressional majority in 40 years. At a time when Republicans didn't have the advantage in generic party preference surveys that they now enjoy. But while Newt Gingrich and Dick Armey are largely given the credit for that very positive vision and document, most don't know how it came to be. It resulted from a highly professional focus group and statistical survey project led by pollster David Winston. To simplify their rigorous process, they went through a long list of issues and positions and found 10 that had 80% public support. As Gingrich famously asked afterwards, "What do you do when you find an 80% issue? You stand next to it and smile." Former Ambassador to the United Nations and former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley in the New York Post this week listed what she and her fellow Republicans are for. She said Republicans stand for everything America needs, especially right now. We are for our country's children to succeed and have the best shot at the best life. We fight for our kids' education. We stand for keeping classrooms open and empowering families to choose the school that's best for them. And we stand for ending critical race theory curricula and anything else that imparts discrimination and instructs kids that some of them are oppressors and others victims simply because of their skin color. Republicans stand for capitalism, the only system that can repair the economy. Republicans stand for public safety and strong borders. We support police. We don't call to defund them. Every American wants to preserve the peace and prevent a war. That's why Republicans stand for American strength. Finally, and most important, every American wants America to survive. That's why Republicans are fighting for our nation's founding principles. We know that our country isn't perfect, but we also know the principles at the heart of our country are perfect. Now is no time to swap liberty, opportunity, free speech, and the rule of law for tyranny, censorship, and the raw exercise of power. Now is the time to apply our principles to make our country freer, better, and fairer for all. What does the Republican Party stand for? Everything that makes America the best country in the world. Everything that can make America even better. The real question is why Joe Biden and the Democratic Party don't. Thank you, Governor Haley. Indeed, Biden is surrendering much of this high ground in our national political discourse. Republicans should embrace the Biden-given opportunity to say what they are for. Utah Republican Congressman Chris Stewart presented his own reply in the Deseret News just this past week. He writes, "From speeches to press conferences to media gaggles, President Joe Biden has asked again and again, what are Republicans for? The standard answer that many Republicans respond with is free enterprise, equal opportunity, freedom from big government, and the protection of constitutional rights. And while I believe this answer may be accurate, I also believe it can be greatly simplified. Mr. President, Republicans are for freedom." Thank you, Congressman Stewart. There are many other things Republicans should be for, such as a consistently strong national defense, a responsible budget and tax policy, strengthening the family unit, economic opportunity for all without quotas, preferential classes, and racial discrimination. Each one of these should be formulated into policy propositions that are rigorously tested with the American people to find the best way of presenting them so that they earn the 80% support that the 10 elements of the contract with America achieved. A campaign adopting that strategy will work, so Republicans should thank President Biden for suggesting it. This has been Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring for American Radio Journal.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country. They include KADA-FM in Ada, Oklahoma, WTRV-FM in Walker, Michigan, along with WTWZ-FM in Jackson, Mississippi. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.